Hello again, another week. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and we have lots of interesting.
Yeah, that's Ann, and this is Peter. Just in case you were wondering,
right?
When people call us, it's really odd when I answer the phone and somebody at the other end of the line says Ann.
Well, yes, we've done that too.
Isn't there something? Isn't there a song about it? If a man answers your phone when I call.
No, I don't know about that.
There's something about that. Anyway, not to worry. We have a...
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to know who called us at 3:30 a.m.
Well, you mean you didn't check out the number?
Oh, I never thought of that.
Well, this first track is very interesting anyway. A young lady, at least young by our standards, has written a really quite remarkable book called The Everlasting Meal. So let's hear what the author had to say about it.
This is Tamar Adler, and she's really a special writer. Now, Tamar Adler, I think it must be some sort of a coup for you to get Alice Waters to do the foreword to your first book called An Everlasting Meal, Cooking with Economy and Grace. Welcome to On the Menu, Tamar.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah. Now, the title, I think we'll get into the book immediately if you just explain this title, An Everlasting Meal, because that says something about your approach to this.
I wanted to, in the title as much as I could, begin to imprint the idea that whenever we cook, we are creating something of a meal past the one we imagine we're cooking for. And if that's always true, then you actually do end up with a sort of meal that keeps on going from the very first time you turn toward your stove and light a burner. And we actually looked, my editor and I looked for the right word to describe that, because once I had called it an endless meal.
Sounds terrible.
That was what she said, that it conjured either gluttony or drudgery.
Yes, exactly.
And you wanted to either stand up or stop cooking at some point. And so it seemed like everlasting had a quality that was uplifting and also a little bit magical.
Yes, I think so too.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Now, when I first started talking to you, I said, actually, I'm looking at your picture and you look like your book, which is difficult for me to explain. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I think I do. I think that I really like that photo, actually, because I think there is something calm about it. And I have been...
Peaceful,
yeah.
Serene. Let's do serene.
I've been so overjoyed to have as many responses to the book as I have that have contained something like that sentiment, which is that people feel comforted and serene about cooking and eating and preparing meals after spending a little time with an everlasting meal, which is such a, I can't imagine a greater compliment than that.
Well, you have to be just so elated for this book. I mean, it's just such an accomplishment.
Thank you.
You're in your early 30s?
Yeah.
I was going to say, this is quite an achievement for somebody who, at least from our perspective, is a rather young person.
Well, it's the same age as our son, actually.
You're 34,
are you?
I'm 34, yes.
Yeah, it's the same age as our son, Adam.
That makes her a rather young person.
Who is not very serene.
Maybe he needs an everlasting meal.
He has two children that have something to do with the lack of serenity.
Yes, I'm sure.
No, I want to say that everybody points to the fact that you have, to some extent, channeled Mary Frances in this book, M.F.K. Fisher, get to that later on. Let's say it does not mean that you were not without really major credentials. I mean, you're forward from Alice Waters. You actually worked at Chez Panisse. You also worked with Gabriel Hamilton. Oh, she always corrects me on that, Gabriel Hamilton, at Prune. And you know what you're talking about, is what I'm saying.
Well, thank you. I think people have asked me why I decided to leave cooking professionally, and also why I started doing it in the first place. And those are always going to be unanswerable questions, but on some level, I feel like this book is the best synthesis of what I want and need and love to do. And I think part of the reason that I felt pulled to cook and did really feel called to cook professionally for quite a while was because I had no way of explaining this thing that I felt like people needed to know without getting really good at it myself. I think I needed not credentials, but practice.
Well, I think people, to understand what we're talking about, will actually have to get and read this book, a chapter called How to Boil Water, which doesn't really tell you what the chapter is about, actually. I mean, it does, but it doesn't.
Well, it's just like How to Cook a Wolf by a McCaffrey.
Yes, well, that's
doesn't have anything to do with actually cooking a wolf.
Right.
Exactly.
Even assuming you could catch one, and even assuming you would want, having caught one, to cook it.
But, I mean, there's such a wonderful sense of poetry going through this. How to teach an egg to fly. How to catch your tail. I just think it's wonderful. I asked you, like, what section you were most proud of, and you said it's the one about the covering your mistakes.
Yeah, I think...
Why is that? Because why is that your favorite?
I think that that is one of the things that new cooks need most to feel empowered to do. Because we do mess up all the time in the kitchen. I mess up all the time in the kitchen, just like we mess up in the rest of our lives. But when we make a wrong turn driving to a new place, we make it a little frustrated, but we quickly turn around and reorient ourselves and keep going toward our destination. We don't assume that we're thwarted just because we've made a wrong turn. And in the kitchen, it seems to me like there is a prevailing sense of anxiety that as soon as we make a wrong turn, we're never going to get where we're going. And I don't think that my chapter on mistakes is my most poetic, but I think it is...
practical.
It is, yeah, it's probably the most practical, because one thing you can be sure of is that there is a mistake to come. Like I say somewhere in the book that you can be sure of hunger. It's the one thing we can count on, that we'll be hungry again. But we can also count on the fact that at some point we'll make a mistake. And I really like having the opportunity to give my philosophy on making a mistake, which is that most of it is about, most of how to deal with mistakes in the kitchen comes back to perspective. Half the time, you end up with something that is unintentional, but edible, usable. You even learn about something that you didn't know you liked. And I think that that's one of the things that we've lost in not having as much grounding in the kitchen as we used to.
That's when I add more fish sauce.
Exactly. Perfect solution. Or put it on toast.
Now you were partway through describing your transition from being a working professional chef to saying you wanted to do something else. Give us what was that turning point? Was it sort of like a Saul of Tarsus on the road to Damascus kind of apparition, or what was it?
Not that far. I think this probably sounds too metaphysical, but at each turn in my strange little career, I have known that it was time for me to make a small transition into doing the next thing. And I've been a magazine editor and then a chef and now an author. But each time I've left one of those, at least in the incarnation in which it was official behind me, people have asked me if I had any idea what I was doing. Because why would I want to not have a great job in publishing? Or why would I want to not be cooking at Chez Panisse? And my answer was always that I very much wanted to be doing those things. But I had to do something else right then. And that was sort of what happened with this book. I really felt like there was a need for it in the world right then. And I also felt like the book was fully formed in me. So I just had to stop and sit down and write it.
That was the other question. How easy was it to write this book? Because it's what some people might describe as deep.
I like that description. It was incredibly hard to write, because something is fully formed inside of you doesn't mean that you know how to help it out.
Right.
And I think that is a terrible challenge. One of my great writing mentors at Harper's Magazine once called not cooking, writing, a lot of problem solving. And that's what cooking is, too. Every time you write something, on some level, you're solving a problem. When you're writing a whole book, it's a lot of problems to deal with. Most of them are getting it out of you, but with An Everlasting Meal, I felt like I was trying to do so much at once, kind of hold people's hands and nudge them along and make them fall in love and explain how all of this was practical. And it was hard to figure out just the right way to do that. I don't think I did, but I did my best.
Yeah, but then you said, well, okay, so I'm not going to be satisfied unless my work is compared to the doyen of all food writers,
M.F. Exactly.
I mean, this is sort of like saying, I'm going to write my first play, and I'm going to write it like Shakespeare.
When I told somebody, when I was really in the throes of the book writing difficulty, I told a friend that one of the things that was so hard was that I knew that I wanted this to be a kind of
reincarnation.
On some level, yeah. And he said, that's like saying that the first cello suites you write are a response to Benjamin Britten's. Why would you say that? Why wouldn't you just write cello suites?
And of course, you like Elizabeth David, too. All these people I love.
I do also.
Once you have this book out, is it out of your system? And are you moving in a different direction?
I immediately dove into another book project.
Okay.
I'm also teaching cooking periodically because it seems like people have really found an actual practical version of this instruction helpful. But it's hard to do those two things at once. And really, apparently, my heart is in this strange, awful process of getting what is going on down on the page.
Well, will it be also in the culinary field?
Yes. I'm stuck.
Okay. All right. And, so there are things you have not yet said in this book.
I think it's a different... I'm approaching a different aspect of cooking in the next one, or of eating. It's going to be a book about appetite. Because
one of the things that seems to me that you were very disciplined about the appetite and the quantities you eat. You're a very light eater.
I am a light eater. People have observed that. But I think we often eat more than we need to because we're not able or don't feel confident enough to make what we have incredibly delicious. It's sort of the have versus lack continuum that I try to make people feel as though they're better positioned on than they think. And the end of this writing has left me with a lot, you know, having read a lot that couldn't go into this book about different recipes we've written over history and moments that it seems like we've been incredibly gluttonous and moments when we've been austere and, you know, ways we've tricked people at the table, and that a lot of that went into earlier drafts of An Everlasting Meal and had to be excised because I didn't think it was gravitational enough. And so now it needs to get woven together into a different book that says, okay, now that we've begun to allow ourselves to consider our appetites as helpful, what are they? Can we look at them more closely, just like we look at cooking more closely?
Do you ever wonder, when a lot of people just think of eating as a bodily function that's required in order for to be calories for their system to burn, that you're sort of glorifying this thing about food a little bit too much?
I don't, because I think that our appetites are things that we are really blessed with. It is an extraordinary thing to be given a set of preferences, particularly when some of them are ones that we really have the ability to satisfy. And obviously not always, but often enough in our culture today, those of us who are privileged enough to have some money to spend on food, even a little bit, an ability or a consciousness of how to satisfy the smallest preference for something crispy or something solid or something soft or something hot or something cold is really humanizing and incredibly lucky. It's just like choosing to walk outside or to lie down when you're tired. And I think that saying that isn't glorifying those things either. It's just sort of remembering that we're given senses for a reason.
Now, we can reemphasize the subtitle of this as Cooking with Economy and Grace, because I must say that it's targeted to our times when budgets are tight. I also want to make sure everybody understands there are real recipes in this book.
and they're good
recipes as well. For some basic things that I've always looked for really good recipes for. I can't throw out the onion peels anymore. You're making me crazy.
Success.
I mean, I'm going to put them in the trash, and I think I can't do that now because you save absolutely everything.
Well, this is who you were telling me about.
Yes.
That is I. You know, I hope it doesn't feel like guilt, though. I hope that it feels enriching, because my point in, I do save everything, but I save it and then quickly put it in a pot and add some water and turn it into something else. And if I save things and have to go out of town and they can't be put into water, then they'll end up in the compost, and and next time I use something, I will save it. And I hope that it just feels to you and to people who read the book as though they're kind of being given a new set of lenses with which to see the stuff that often gets thrown away. Because it...
Oh, Tamar, you do that indeed. I mean, you're very successful at that. And I just think it will make such a difference to people if they get a hold of this book and read it.
Now, it seems to me, Tamar, that there's only one question you've been unable to answer to our satisfaction, which is why you're named after a river. but apparently you never even knew there was a river called the Tamar, so you are to be forgiven.
I'm off the hook.
You're off the hook, yes. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's been such a good deal of fun.
Keep us posted on your next venture.
I will. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Tamar.
And we'll be right back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and come with us as we step into this unexpectedly large Puffalicious, that's on the cover.
Puffalicious, yeah.
Puffalicious, yeah. World of marshmallows.
It's a little bit like going from the sublime to the ridiculous.
No, I mean, it's just, and you know, I just realized something, because I've been looking at the author Shauna's name for a long time until I talked to her. I didn't realize that although it's spelled S-E-V-E-R, it's actually pronounced Savor. Now, isn't that another example of names?
Meaning something?
Meaning occupations and passions.
I suppose. I think you might be taking two extremes there.
But Savor?
Listen, everybody wants to know about marshmallows.
Okay, well, this is the book to go to if you want to know about marshmallows.
So here it is.
I love the cover of this cookbook that I'm holding in my hands because it's just so one with the subject. We're talking to Shauna.
Shauna Savor.
Savor, okay. And it's a squishy, fluffy cover. All pastel-y and beautiful, cheerful, and it's a book called Marshmallow Madness. I just had so much fun with this. As I told you, Shauna, I mean, for years, I really did believe that marshmallows grew on bushes.
You mean they don't?
Well, yeah, mallow is the thing that I was thinking of. Isn't that a tree thing?
I don't know.
Marshmallow root is actually, yeah, the sap from the marshmallow root was actually the first kind of incarnation of a marshmallow before it was sweetened.
So there is a
plant substance.
There is a plant substance in this. Now, there isn't a plant substance in there anymore, is there?
No. They've evolved quite a bit over time.
Well, I asked you why you called this book Marshmallow Madness, and I guess actually just looking through it, with so many variations and so much creativity in the shapes and the colors and the this and that, that it's like encyclopedic, but lots of fun. And it is a little crazy, Shauna.
It is a little bit crazy. Like I said, someone gives you the green light to sort of explore a single topic. It's really fun as a recipe developer and writer to just kind of see how far you can take it.
So that's what you do in your real life?
Yes, I do. I'm a writer. I've had a food blog. It's called Piece of Cake. You can also find it at shaunasever.com, which is my website. But
I wanted to mention that a piece of cake is your blog.
Yes. Okay. And I've had that for almost going on 5 years now. And
wow.
So, yeah, out of that came the opportunity to write a book, which has been kind of a dream come true.
Well, now, I can't do justice to this book without people seeing it. You explore so many different shapes and forms and flavors of marshmallows. I never knew that it could exist. I'm looking at one, though, I'm not really anxious to try, called bubblegum marshmallows. But it's pretty.
Well, do you want to know something? The funny thing about the bubblegum marshmallow is that it actually turned out to be one of my favorite flavors in the book. And I think the thing that's so great about the bubblegum marshmallow is that it just encapsulates everything that a marshmallow is, which is sweet and light and fun. And in that recipe, we actually use candy oils, which are really highly concentrated flavoring that you can buy in these little tiny bottles. And it just takes a few drops to add a flavoring to any kind of candy that you make. And the funny thing about the bubblegum marshmallow is that because it has a little bit of bounce and a little bit of chew like a marshmallow, you bite into it and you taste the bubblegum and you're like, oh, it's a piece of bubblegum. And then as you chew, it just gets very soft and it kind of melts in your mouth and it tastes pink and fluffy and lovely. I mean, people actually, they go bananas for that one. That was one of the earliest flavors that I would make for parties, favors, and dessert tables and things, and now, everybody loved them.
Now, I have an environmental responsibility question about bubblegum marshmallows. When you drop them or spit them out on the sidewalk, do they stay there forever?
Well, you
you wouldn't want to do that. You wouldn't want to stick them out on the sidewalk.
No, the thing that really horrifies me, and we're going to experience this again very soon because we're making our annual pilgrimage to London, but when I lived there in the 1960s, there was no stickiness of bubblegum all over what we, because we call the pavement, what you call the sidewalk. And now there is. And you have to be careful that you don't stick to the sidewalk. So if you want your bubblegum, you should have it in a marshmallow, then it will be biodegradable, huh?
Well, no, that's absolutely true. And actually, that's a great thing about the whole marshmallow making process, is that because everything is pretty much just all sugar, everything is very easy to clean, surprisingly. All water soluble.
Well, you do classic flavors, and then you do lots of tricks with the shapes, and you even have these swirly things on sticks, which I think is just clever as anything. And then you also go into this section on mallow connoisseur, for the mallow connoisseur, and you have things like maple bacon, which is called the Elvis, pineapple rosemary, sea salt caramel swirl, salted peanut, mallows in the raw. Those are all very creative.
Oh, thank you. And that section, it is more of sophisticated palate kind of flavors. You do a lot with the sweet and salty balance in those flavors. Even though I did quite a lot to make sure that my marshmallow recipe isn't the kind of tooth-achingly sweet one that you'll get so often. I mean, I find that a lot of people are saying that these recipes are, it's not, quite as sweet as I thought it would be, and they're nicely balanced just on their own, but here you put in a different sort of salty element to really make it kind of addictive and give it a little bit of an edge, and so it's fun to play with those flavors.
Now, I have two questions that are sort of different. One is, how big can you make a marshmallow?
How big?
Well, there's a reason behind the question, because within the last few months we interviewed one of a couple of guys in London called the Jellymongers.
Oh, I was going to suggest that she get together with the Jellymongers. Look them up. Do their website.
But they make things that are very large, so they have like a jelly of St. Paul's Cathedral, or a jelly of the Houses of Parliament.
Not full scale.
No, but obviously, I mean, if you made a regular marshmallow, and it was St. Paul's, but it was the size of a normal marshmallow, you wouldn't be able to tell.
No.
You wouldn't be able to tell what it was. So that's why I asked the question, could you really make one that was like...
How big can you make a marshmallow?
2 feet tall or something like that?
Well, you could make a marshmallow about as big as you wanted to, because really what you do is, you scrape the marshmallow batter after it's whipped. You can spray it into any conceivable mold as long as it's sprayed with a little nonstick cooking spray.
Uh-huh.
So I suppose if you, tripled or quadrupled the recipe and found yourself a mold of St. Paul's Cathedral, you could make a big, huge marshmallow structure.
You need to go on this website. It's jellymongers.uk.
co.uk.
Okay. I would definitely check that out. That sounds fun.
Yeah.
And if you don't have any luck connecting with them, let us know and we'll send them an email.
Well, I think that there's a certain breed of person who does things, as crazy as that, or a book on marshmallows, so I'm sure that we would get along.
Maybe you could do joint projects.
Yeah, they do exhibitions in museums like San Francisco Art Museum and stuff.
So you could do a combination jelly and marshmallow. Boy, wouldn't that be something?
Yeah, if you can figure out how they do black light stuff, so the clothes in the dark or in black light.
I don't think you can do that with a marshmallow.
Now,
here's the other thing that I don't know much about, because we never did this growing up. If we were toasting things, mm-hmm. we used to toast crumpets and bread to make toast. And this whole concept of toasting a marshmallow, it's called a s'more. I don't really know anything about that.
She has recipe for homemade graham crackers in here, too.
Oh, okay. Well, what do homemade graham crackers have to do with s'mores?
That's what they are. Explain to him what a s'more is, Shauna.
Well, a s'more, I guess it is kind of like a really American, all-American thing, isn't it?
I don't know. I never realized it.
A s'more is really like your standard campfire fare, where you take a marshmallow and you roast it over a fire, and then you sandwich it between two graham crackers with a slab of chocolate bar.
Oh, okay. So that's where the graham crackers come in. Okay.
Yes. Now, there are homemade graham cracker recipes, a traditional one, and then also one that is vegan and gluten-free.
No, I was really worried that one of the things I'm sure would happen to me if I was doing s'mores is I would cook them too long and they would drop off into the fire.
Well, they do do that.
They do that.
Yeah, you have to get the technique down.
You have to get the technique down, okay.
It is a fine art, yes.
Yes. And you have a section here, I would call them adult marshmallows for happy hour.
Yes, our cocktail-inspired marshmallows.
Right, but they don't have actual booze in them.
Oh, yes, they do.
Oh, they do, okay.
Yes, they do.
You have a margarita, buttered rum, a fuzzy navel, creme de menthe, and a Malibu.
Yes, which is the coconut rum with twisted coconut.
And you serve them in a cocktail glass.
You could serve them any way that you want to. I think it was just a really fun thing to explore, you know, using different flavored alcohols as a way to get a little more flavor into the marshmallow. And you do taste a little bit of the booziness. It is really a fun thing. A lot of people have been picking up on the margarita marshmallows because we actually found sort of a Swedish pearl sugar that you would use to make Swedish pancakes or waffles. It's that very coarse sugar that actually looks a little bit like rock salt or margarita salt. And so we roll the margarita marshmallows in the Swedish pearl sugar, and it gives them like a really great look and really fun texture.
And you could make an old-fashioned, I guess you could make a Manhattan, you could make a Sazerac.
You can. And this is what I wanted to do, like especially in the alcohol section, because the thing I found making the marshmallows with alcohol is that the proof of the alcohol really affected the outcome of the marshmallow. So it's not as simple as just swapping out the same measure for any alcohol.
Uh-huh.
What I did in that section is there's pretty much just a few amount of different amounts of proofs out there. So what you want to do is pay attention to the proof of the alcohol that you want to use. For something for like an old fashioned, I mean, you'd be dealing with like a whiskey or something that has really high proof. So you want to go in and kind of find an existing recipe in the book that has alcohol in it with a similar proof in order to get a good result, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense. Everything you say makes sense.
Yeah.
It's really quite remarkable for a book with a squishy cover to make sense.
It's so much. And you have a craft section on what you do with these marshmallows, because that was another question. What in the world do you do with all these marshmallows?
Well, there's a lot of fun things that you can do with them. Of course, like I said, you could scrape all the batter into a pan, and then when it's set, you let it set for about 6 hours or so, and then you can just cut it into cubes. But any conceivable mold can become a vessel for marshmallows. So everything from, I use mini muffin tins to ice cube trays to, I mean, you can buy candy molds in all shapes and sizes from a baking or candy making supply store. It's amazing what's out there. But I also like to load it into a piping bag with a round tip or any kind of tip, actually. And you can pipe little clouds or homemade marshmallow peeps, or you can do a lot with this and make your own homemade mini marshmallows. If you just pipe long lines of marshmallow along a baking sheet that's been prepped with a little nonstick cooking spray, and then once those sort of longer marshmallow ropes are set, you can just snip them into mini marshmallows. Actually, the cover is just a collage of different marshmallow shapes that we made and just sort of threw them all down on a surface and shot it, and then that became the colorful cover that you see. But yeah, there is a lot that you can do with it. It's a little, not the consistency of clay, but that same sort of idea that you can really form it into anything that you want it to be.
Sort of a little bit like silly putty.
But much fluffier.
It's really unbelievable. You've taken marshmallows to the extreme.
And as it says, puffalicious extreme.
I can hardly wait to find out what you're going to do next.
Well, we are doing, actually I'm working on my second book right now. We're in editing for a book called Pure Vanilla, and it is a bigger book than the first book, more images, more information. It's sort of half vanilla recipe collection, very vanilla forward baking recipes, but there's also some savory in there as well. And then there's a big portion of the book that's sort of a vanilla primer, where we talk about where vanilla comes from, how it's harvested, the different flavor profiles depending on the origin of the vanilla and where it's grown. It really is a really fascinating topic. So that's what I'm working on now. And yes, there is a marshmallow recipe in the vanilla book as well.
Well, you have, be careful, and don't call the book The Vanilla Queen.
No, it's not only that, she's tackling head-on.
Because the Vanilla Queen is a real
vanilla
person. But you could undoubtedly be the Vanilla Princess. I can hardly wait.
And the Masseys has a vanilla book out, too.
Yeah. Well, they do, because they make vanillas.
They do.
Right. And there are a couple of vanilla books that have been written, certainly not as many, but the millions of books that have been written on chocolate. It's really sort of an underappreciated kind of flavor, and it's not something that we think about too often as being the star of dishes. But I think in this book, you know, you can really focus not just on the great flavor of vanilla, but it really allows you to pay attention to textures as well and really kind of get a well-rounded eating experience.
You must come back and talk to us again when that project is completed. And in the meantime, thank you so much for joining us on The Menu.
Good to meet you, Shona.
Nice to meet you, too.
So who said there wasn't a lot to say about marshmallows, huh?
I never said that.
You never said that. Well, you certainly found out a lot, listeners. I hope you enjoyed it and found it interesting, and now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and as it were, we're still on a sweet theme, aren't we, sweetheart? Who's next?
Yeah, and we have a Jenny Britton Bauer, who's become really just about universally famous for her splendid ice creams, and now she's written a book, and you can make them at home.
Yeah, or you can buy them, which is an even quicker way to satisfy yourself.
But she's one of the top ice cream makers
in
the country.
I never knew there was so much about making ice cream till we talked to Jenny. It's really quite amazing the lengths to which they go. And she said something really interesting that you'll catch during the interview, but I thought it was really quite remarkable. She said, if we don't make ice cream better today than we did yesterday, we're going to quit doing it.
The Department of Health and Human Services has determined that the body mass index of adults and children in Franklin County, Ohio, is several percentage points above the national average. And we are interviewing today the person who is single-handedly, together with a few friends, I guess, responsible for that, Jenny of Jenny's Ice Cream. Hello, Jenny. Welcome to On the Menu Radio.
Well, hi there.
Is Jenny
able to get that
power, huh?
It's Jenny Britton Bauer, yes.
Yes, and it's the book is called Jenny's Splendid Ice Creams at Home, and the ice cream stores themselves are mainly in Ohio. How many do you have?
We have 10 stores.
Okay.
One is in East Nashville, Tennessee.
Yes, and you came out of Columbus, Ohio.
Right in the middle of Ohio, Columbus.
Yeah, which I have family in, right. Everybody's raving about the testimonials on the back of the book. Just goes through everybody.
Let's do one very important thing.
Okay.
Because Jenny's not spelled like our great niece. It's J-E-N-I, right?
Right.
That's correct.
So if you went J-E-N-N-Y-S ice cream on the internet, you might come up sadly short or get something that's not the right thing. We can't have that, can we?
That's right. You'd probably still get to me, but yes, I'd spell it J-E-N-I-S
without the apostrophe.
Oh, okay.
Is it?
And that's a result of being in my generation. In 1973, when I was born, every other girl was named Jenny, so we all had to differentiate ourselves somehow.
How old are you now?
I'm 38.
Okay, well, because my daughter-in-law is Jen, but she's like 10 years younger than you. But she's Jen.
Now you've given that secret away. You'll be in trouble. If Adam and Jen listen to the program, you'll be in big trouble.
I will be in big trouble. She's going to get off, not to worry.
When they complain, I'll just have to put your age out on the air. And that'll
well,
be
it went from like 1973 all the way through the 80s. I mean, it was just, there's a lot of Jennies in the world from that.
There are.
First, years. Yeah, there are. And we used to, I've had classes with 24 kids and 8 of them are Jennies.
Oh, wow. Why is your ice cream so wonderful? I mean, there's so many reasons.
There are some secrets you were just telling us, so let's let the audience in on the secrets.
Well, the simplest answer is because we try to make it better every single day, and we know we're going to make better ice cream tomorrow than we do today, and we know we make better ice cream today than we did yesterday. We work with grass-pastured milk and cream from a few small farms. We've been able to, over many years, get very, very close. I mean, it's easy in Ohio to get very close to the source on things like strawberries. but we're also getting very close to the source on our vanilla bean, for instance, which we import directly from a small farm in Uganda. Our ice creams are handmade, hand-built, we like to say, to an almost ridiculous degree, but it really makes a difference, all those little details.
Now, if someone goes on your website, they can find out where they can actually get this ice cream?
Yes, Jenny's jennysicecreams.com. You can find stores that carry our ice cream. You can actually order it on the website.
Oh, you can.
And we'll send it to you right from our kitchen, and it'll be there within a couple of days. Sometimes
wow.
It just takes one day.
But let's get these secrets out, because there are some, I feel like, scientific parts of the secret as well, right? That some ingredients you include and one you don't?
Well, it's true. And most of my, I went to art school and studied art history, so when I started making ice cream, I thought...
And so did I. Where did you go? You went to...
I went to Ohio State, right down the street from where I grew up.
Right. Yeah, I have a degree in art history, too. Do you know who else does? Ruth Reichel. We both have masters in art history from University of Michigan. And there's somebody else
wonderful.
Who has a degree in art history.
Well, Jenny's ice cream is another one.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
Well, I'll tell you, I was actually studying art history and art, and I started making ice cream right in the middle of it, and then I left school to make ice cream. But I thought that it was going to be a big art project, and it was just going to be like, I was going to be a pastry chef, or it's going to just make ice cream, and it was going to be sort of like making art. And it is very similar in many ways, but it really is all science. And so I had to devote myself over many years to the science of making ice cream, which I found very difficult at first, and it's gotten a lot easier to me, but I almost consider myself more of a scientist now than an artist. And that's, when I wrote the recipe for the book, I wanted to mimic, I didn't want to just go get the 200-year-old custard recipe that's been out there for years. I actually wanted home cooks to be able to make exactly the same texture and consistency that I get out of my kitchen, but I wanted, in their own kitchens at home, because once you get the texture right, you can put any flavor you want on top of it. And so that was just I worked backwards from the texture I wanted to achieve and used all the science that I've learned over the last few years, and I achieved that.
Now, you went to Penn State, didn't you, in their program?
I did go to Penn State. I went to Penn State. That was in 2000, which is great for large-scale ice cream manufacturing. But I also have done a lot of work with the Ohio State University. It was a great dairy science program, which it is in my backyard, and I was able to spend as much time as I wanted there, and I know all of the people who are in charge there, and lots of grad students and lots of students. So I was able to really learn everything I needed to know about ice cream making in real time as I was doing it here in Columbus, which has been a huge help.
Oh, that sounds great.
No, and you expressed surprise for a second there, but remember that Ohio State and Penn State are both land-grant universities, which were founded to, in fact, support the agricultural development of
their
ag universities.
Yeah, they're ag universities, right.
So we still have, we've got cows that we actually buy cream from that are a part of Ohio State University right down, within a 2-minute drive from where I'm sitting right now, which is unusual for even a Midwestern or, I don't know if Ohio is really the Midwest, but anyway, for a town, even a city in Ohio to have cows, a whole working dairy within literally 5 minutes from downtown, you can see the downtown skyline from the dairy that's at Ohio State, which I think is so cool. And in the spring, it smells like cows, which I love, but it's right down the street from us because of Ohio State, which is something that I've always been very proud of and really excited about.
Uh-huh. Now, isn't it true, though, that the cows are a special breed and their colors are gray and red?
the Ohio State University cows?
Yes.
I love that. I think they would like them to be that. Yes, but they're not naturally like that. They have to paint them. They get all the artists from the art school to come over and paint them.
Now I'm still trying to get you to underline these special secrets of what's in and what's not in your ice cream.
Egg yolks.
Okay, well,
egg yolks are not in.
Remember that.
We don't use egg yolks in our ice cream. And we've in the beginning we tried everything, of course. We've worked with egg yolks a lot. But egg yolks impart a specific flavor, which is sometimes awesome and great. But more importantly, egg yolks have a fat. The fat that's in egg yolks melt at a much, much lower temperature. So when you freeze it and it goes in and you lick it off of your cone, you end up getting this fat build up on your tongue. And this is all very much very sort of scientific. It's very brittle when it's frozen. Whereas butter fat, that's the fat that's in milk and cream, it melts exactly, actually 2 degrees below body temperature. And this is really important because all fats melt have a different melting point. And when you're making ice cream, you want that melting point to be lower than body temperature. And egg yolk fats melt above body temperature. And so you end up getting, and so do chocolate, actually. So if you freeze a chocolate bar and take a bite out of it, you don't end up tasting it. It has to melt. It has to completely come to body temperature.
That's where I heard that before, interviewing a chocolatier. That's it, yeah.
That's right. It has to come to body temperature. It has to be actually completely melt in order to be able to taste it, which is why chocolate should be eaten at room temperature. And anyway, you know, when you put a pat of butter on your hand, it immediately starts melting, and that's the same with when you lick butterfat, you know, cream, butterfat-rich cream from a cone, it relaxes immediately on your tongue, and whatever you've scented it with blooms into your nose. I mean, butterfat is known to carry flavor from wherever into your nose, from your plate, from the cone
true,
into your nose. Sucks flavor in.
Now, hold on just a second, Jenny. Now, you're talking about this with such great authority, but it must be that a lot of ice creams actually do contain egg yolk.
Yes.
That's right. Yes, a lot of ice creams do contain, and a lot of ice creams contain a very tiny amount of egg yolk, because egg yolk can, it's just, if it's one of the last ingredients, then most likely it's being used as an emulsifier, which is fine, which is great. If it's got a lot of egg yolks in it, for me, it imparted too much flavor, and then that fat buildup that I didn't like. And we find that we don't need an emulsifier at all in our ice cream, so we homogenize our ice cream, and that serves to give us the shelf life we need, which is very little, and we don't need it for some reason an emulsifier. Actually, you know, when you're using this kind of milk and cream that we're using and treating it the way we are with the pasteurizer, it means that we don't need an emulsifier. So that's the other reason we really don't need egg yolks.
You have this, the quality down pat, you have the texture down pat, you have all these qualities of ice cream down pat, but there's something unique about yours. First of all, your flavors are certainly not the run-of-the-mill flavors. They're more like something an artist would design, and they're also seasonal.
That's right. Well, we have our signature flavors that we always have, we've had for years, like our salty caramel, the dark chocolate, our lemon yogurt. We have one we call Bangkok peanut.
And
these are flavors that we've just developed over the years, and they've just stuck. People love them. But then every year we have what we call perennial flavors that come back every year. So our roasted strawberry buttermilk, or in the summer we take a whole field of blueberries and make it into like a jam and put that in our lemon yogurt. We do sweet corn and black raspberry.
Oh, I like the sound of that one, by the way.
It's so great. They're in season right at the same time, those two ingredients, so we just put them together and they're wonderful.
Yeah, I was reading about that last summer. I think you were actually doing some demos, and I thought that was brilliant.
Oh, it's so good. We've been making it for years and years and years. Our customers long for it. In fact, we have customers who buy it when they know it's going out of season and, like, archive it in chest freezers in their basement so they can keep it through the winter.
How about Gucci Moo Moo?
Well, so flavors like Gucci Moo Moo come, that's a milk, a very milky chocolate. We actually add condensed milk to give it that almost fudgy, milky, kulfi kind of texture and flavor, and then add curry, just a kind of off-the-shelf yellow curry that I love, this sort of sweet curry, and coconut, and it's just wonderful. But flavors like that we usually do with collections, and so every couple of months we'll do like a collection of some of ice creams just inspired by whatever we feel like doing, so that we're not limited. And usually it'll follow the emotion of the season, but not necessarily what's growing. So it's really fun. So this year, all year, we're thinking about America. It's the election year where we're going to do, for early spring going into summer, we're doing American writers. It's very loosely inspired by American writers. We want to remind people that we're in America, we got a vote, this is election year, this is a big year, this is a fun year.
What? Give me an example of inspired by American writers ice cream.
And they're very loosely inspired, but this is how we have fun. So we have Edna St. Vincent Millay, who's one of my favorite poets, who was alive in the early 1917 through the 50s, I think. She was a very sort of an adventuresome person. She was a free spirit. She spent some time in Japan in the early 20s. And so we're doing a plum sake. Have a plum. It's a sake that's made of plum, and then pureed plums. Sorbet, which is a beautiful flavor. And so it has this almost sprightly, beautiful, free spirit sort of flavor. And then we're doing a flavor after James Thurber, because my hometown here, Columbus, Ohio, is celebrating its bicentennial, and James Thurber is from Columbus. And so we're doing his martini. We're doing a juniper ice cream with lemon curd, a juniper-infused cream with lemon curd, and it's so wonderful.
That sounds wonderful. I'm very worried, though. I'm worried about ice creams inspired by Rick Santorum and... what's his name? Romney? I've forgotten his first name. And Newt Gingrich obviously loves Jenny's ice cream. You can tell that.
I have zero inspirations coming to mind when I'm thinking about them.
Thank goodness for that. I'm relieved.
Can I change the subject? What about Gorgonzola Dolce ice cream with candied walnuts? I want to give listeners a sense of the range, the wild creative range of your ice cream flavors. How about Oakville Young Gouda ice cream with vodka plumped cranberries?
Oh, yeah. So it's not, I mean, these are so great. The Oakdale Young Gouda ice cream, we would go to a local dairy who was making this Gouda and pull the Gouda when it was still very young and very, very creamy. And it basically tasted like the best, richest cheesecake you could ever have. And then to cut through that, we made these really intensely flavored, almost like hot alcohol-fused cranberries that were dried cranberries. And it was a huge hit. The Gorgonzola ice cream is, it's funny, it doesn't, I mean, it has the flavor of blue cheese, but in just this perfect way. And I always serve it with something like a pear tart. And it is just the right, sometimes, you said you don't have a sweet tooth. Sometimes I don't have a sweet tooth either at the end of a meal or certain times. And
after
this is like
tasting
the perfect
the ice cream.
Dessert. Or, you know, if I want to keep drinking red wine or, you know, if I don't want to put that down and I don't need another a big piece of chocolate cake or whatever, something like Gorgonzola Dolce with candy walnuts and a small sliver of pear tart is the perfect dessert. It's almost a cheese course.
Now, let me ask you, you have in your... I'm sure you don't have all of this in every one of your shops, but you have the scoops, your traditional flavors, and the more creative flavors that are seasonal. And homemade cones, is it?
Yeah, we do.
Okay. Cake cones, which are my favorite things.
And me too. I always think of them like rice paper. I love those cake cones.
Oh, yeah. And then you have frozen yogurt, sorbets. You have sundaes. Talk to us a little bit about these unusual sundaes.
That's my sort of poison. When I get to the store, that's what I always order. We make this extra bitter hot fudge first of all, it's a hot fudge that we don't use cream. It's just sugar syrup and chocolate, basically. And it's great because, you know, you're always putting it on ice cream, so you don't need more cream in your hot fudge, but it's a great clash. So even just a vanilla ice cream hot fudge sundae with, you know, I always, or when I order whipped cream, I order too much whipped cream, because they never understand how much I want. So I say a hot fudge sundae, vanilla ice cream with too much whipped cream and smoked almonds is my order. And I love that. But we also do these like sort of plated sundaes, but they're always messy and fun. Our farmer's market sundae in the summer is really popular. It's our lemon yogurt with fresh berries we just pulled from the farmer's market and usually soaked in port or some wine and sugar. I love that one.
Yeah,
and you know, for me, it just means it's spring because we have that for a few months. We have this one called the One Night in Bangkok, which is my favorite sundae, especially when I was pregnant. So we have a peanut butter and toasted coconut milk and cayenne ice cream. And we put our praline, it's like a brown sugar sauce, and peanuts on it. And it's so we do a fortune cookie we make the cone and put a fortune in it. So we fold it like a fortune cookie. And so we have so much fun with fortunes.
Well, you seem to have a lot of fun with everything. How, if you keep expanding, are you going to maintain this high quality artisanal standard?
Well, we've found when we were a smaller company, we couldn't even get close to what we wanted. We couldn't buy ingredients directly the way, certainly not dairy and vanilla beans or any exotic ingredients. And even had trouble even with something like strawberries because our farmer he wasn't that excited about selling us two flats of strawberries that he could make more money on in the farmer's market. And so we would have to wait at the end of the day, and if he had some left over, he would sell them to us at a discount, or else we'd just pay retail price.
Oh,
and
wow.
He wanted his customers to have them. But now, from the same farmer, we buy an entire field of strawberries. And so now we're making his year. He's planting the exact strawberries that we want. We're a team. He's a partner of ours. And for many of these producers, even our goat cheese producer, Jean McKenzie, for her to drive down, a couple of things of goat cheese was 2 hours away, it's not that big of a deal. But if she can bring a whole bunch down for us to make ice cream out of, then it's great. We're helping her achieve her dream of being in business. She used to be a flight attendant. We're just finding that we are actually making better ice cream this way. And if we ever get to the point where we think our ice cream is not getting better, then we'll stop. That's our sole goal is to make the best ice cream as possible.
I hope you keep going until you have a shop next to my house.
The retail shops are our favorite thing. I mean, I absolutely love the challenge of doing retail, the fun of having the one-on-one with customers, telling the stories of our ice creams, because each one of our flavors has a story, a big story, you know, whether it's just the producers and the suppliers, people who grew the ingredients, or how we came up with it and the inspirations and how we did the artwork. And sometimes we even write poetry or music to accompany them.
Oh, you're wonderful.
We do all of our art and design in-house, too, and all of our writing, so that's all a part of the fun.
Well. And it's all in this wonderful book, which is called
Jenny's Splendid Ice Creams at Home.
So get yourself a copy, and if you're on a diet, just look at the pictures.
Yes.
Well, if you're on a diet, just have one bite. Or you know what I would say? If you're on a diet, just invite more friends.
Good. Well, Jenny, it's been so much fun talking to you. It makes me feel like it's summer already.
It is, I think. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and I'm going to turn this over. Peter's the go-to beer guy.
Oh, he's the go-to beer guy. Yeah, well, this is not just a promotion for beer. In fact, it's beer that's quite difficult to get in the United States from the Steam Whistle Brewery in Toronto. The great thing about it is that they have a fascinating premises and a great tour.
Yeah.
So if you're going to Toronto, or you're thinking about going to Toronto, you need to listen to this track. And if you're not going to Toronto just now, you need to file it away in your memory bank so that you can come back to it when you are going to do that. Because unlike Cleveland, which we lovingly call the mistake on the lake, Toronto is quite the opposite, quite a wonderful city, delightfully situated on Lake Ontario, and with a lot of great things to see, but Steam Whistle Brewery tour is certainly one of them.
Now we're welcoming a guest from across the border, across the 49th parallel, or across the Great Lakes in this particular case, from the Dominion of Canada, Sybil Taylor. Welcome to On the Menu.
Thank you very much for having me.
And thank you so much for joining us, and before joining us, allowing us to taste your wonderful product, which we're going to talk a little bit more about in due course. And we're particularly grateful because it turns out that Steam Whistle beer is something of a rarity in these United States and in other parts of the world, for that matter, because you make and distribute only in Canada.
That's right. We opened the brewery about a decade ago in Toronto, and we're probably one of the more well-known and successful craft breweries in our country. And we make just one beer, Steam Whistle Pilsner, which is a bohemian-style Pilsner. And our motto is, do one thing really, really well.
And the interesting thing is that the beer it reminds me of the most is Pilsner Urquell, which is
the ultimate.
which is produced for something north of 150 years in Bohemia.
That's right. Our brewmaster, Marek Mukunda, actually comes from Pilsen, Czech Republic. We hired him specifically because we wanted somebody who was passionate about and really understood the craftsmanship and culture of the Pilsner style of beer. He had gone to a technical brewing high school and then went on to do his Master's of Brewing at the Prague Institute, which is Czech Republic's most esteemed university, and he did actually work at Pilsner Urquell, which was the birthplace of Pilsners in 1842.
Yeah. Now is he still with you?
Yes.
That's wonderful. I thought the most incredible thing we learned when we interviewed somebody from Pilsner Urquell is that the original brewery is still running. Now they have a big modern one next to it, but they keep producing from the old one just so that they can make sure that Pilsner Urquell from the newer brewery tastes the same. Isn't that a wonderful idea?
Yes, I have toured it. Starting last year, we began taking employees who have worked at Steam Whistle Brewing for 5 years or more. We take them on a trip through Munich and the Czech Republic, visiting 5 or 6 different breweries and taking an Oktoberfest, of course, the most amazing beer event in the world, to sort of help everyone learn about the European culture of beer, the founding of the Pilsner style. And we visited Pilsner Urquell, and Marek's old friends and colleagues there toured us around, and we were down in the caves under the brewery, under the city where they store the beer, and drinking from these old wooden barrels, and it was quite a religious experience, I have to tell you.
Now, how wonderful. Now, for those people who are craft beer fanatics, we need to tell them, don't we, that they'll be safe when they go to Canada. They won't have to bring their beer with them because there's an excellent selection of craft beers available across the country.
That's right. We're in the province of Ontario. We have about 43 different craft breweries, and obviously there are similar ones all over the country, and there's a full range of flavors and styles and even some unique that have been invented here, so there's a lot to choose from. We've sort of decided to be a little bit different than most craft breweries that tend to offer a lot of different varieties and different seasonal offerings. We think we're the only brewery in North America and perhaps the world that only makes one style of beer, and that being our Pilsner. And we just decided that in order to achieve excellence you need to really be focused and dedicated, and we're able to put all of our resources and our efforts into a true quality product and experience for our customers.
Now, one of the things we wanted to talk about with you about, and I think this is one of the reasons why you were so interested in getting in touch with us, is that a highlight that you can add to a visit to the wonderful city of Toronto is to be able to tour your brewery.
That's right. Tell
us a little bit about that.
Well, first of all, it's about proximity. We're right across the street from Toronto's sort of preeminent tourist landmark, the CN Tower, which is right beside the Rogers Centre, where our baseball team plays, and down the street from the hockey arena. So people are often in this area visiting tourists anyway. But we're right across the street in what is a museum of the rail history of this city. And we share the building with the train museum and Toronto's historic John Street Roundhouse, and it's a beautiful building from 1929, which was originally built to service all the steam locomotives and passenger trains that came in and out of Union Station. And it was retired in 1988, obviously as car traffic grew and rail traffic lessened. This building wasn't used for its original purpose, and it had been sitting empty for about a decade, and we were fortunate enough to take it over and build our brewery here. So,
well, isn't that wonderful? Now, for those people who don't know about trains as much as I do, because I grew up with steam engine trains, the roundhouse is particularly important because it's how you turn the engine around so that you can put it on the front of the train, so it comes in on the front of the train and it needs to get to the other end and turn around. And they do
right.
that. They do that with rails that do exactly that. They make a 180 or a total 360, but the 180 that's required to be able to get the locomotive pointing in the right direction again.
That's right. The building is horseshoe-shaped with a turntable in the middle, and there are actually 32 bays in the building, big old 30-foot doors that open up that the trains would have driven into. And we occupy bays 1 to 14, which is about 40,000 square feet,
that's so
big. It's substantial. But it's a beautiful old building with huge Douglas beams and old brick and beautiful windows with natural light. And we welcome tours 7 days a week, every half hour. And
how does somebody sign up?
Well, you can just walk in off the street. You don't have to have a reservation. It's first come, first serve. We do take reservations for large groups, and during the week you can take a reservation. But on the weekends, it's just first come, first serve. Last year, we had about 100,000 visitors, so it is a very popular site. And when you're here, there's a lot that you can take in. We have just a retail area where you can buy beer or our fantastic merchandise, but we also have a gallery where local artists display their work, and then, of course, the tours run, which is really the reason why most people come. And the tours take about half an hour, and we've hired really fantastic, young, energetic, interesting, fun people to be our tour guides. So people generally are quite entertained as visitors, and they're also informed. We train our visitors, we train our tour guides very well on brewing history, on what goes into crafting our beer, the ingredients. And we're also known as one of Canada's greenest employers.
Oh, and that's
so
good to know.
Yeah, there are a lot of interesting sustainability initiatives that we have here at the brewery as well. So, you know, we are a part of that local food movement where people are choosing better products to drink and eat.
You may be sure that the next time we get to Toronto,
steam whistle will be
on our agenda. I'm guessing that what you call the Rogers Communications Center is what we used to call the Sky Dome.
That's right, the Sky Dome's right across the street.
And we went up the CN Tower, but I didn't go at the last part. we actually met my brother and his wife and his three sons in Toronto when they were quite young, and it was the first place they wanted to go.
We had all these little boys.
they of course went all the way to the top, and I went as close to the bottom as I could.
I'm sure the city's developed a lot since you were last here. The downtown core railway lands have actually been now developed with a lot of condominiums and parks and restaurants, and there's more of a connection to the harbor front. And we're just within maybe 10 or 15 minute walk of probably the top tourist attractions in the city, including St. Lawrence Market, which is where you can go to all kinds of fantastic food stalls and butchers and cheese producers and so on. So there's a lot to do and see here.
Oh, yeah. In the summer, this is going to shoot to the top of our list.
I have a feeling that you're running a fifth column for the Government of Ontario Tourism Bureau. and you're doing an extremely fine job. I've actually been in Toronto. I think the last time was probably in the mid-1980s, and the trend you were talking about, the redevelopment of the land between the city and the lake, which was occupied by the old railroad tracks, that had already started, and it was clear that it was going to be complete very soon.
And the traffic was a nightmare.
Yeah.
I remember that, too.
Yeah, but we're certainly overdue to come and visit, so you may be sure we'll do that. In the meantime, Sybil, thank you so much for joining us on the menu, and please give our regards to your brewmeister from Bohemia.
I will. Well, I do welcome people to have a look virtually if they don't get a chance to come in person.
Okay.
Steamwhistle.ca is our website, and there's a fantastic virtual tour, a film you can look at. We have 150 recipes for cooking with beer. There's music you can download of the Canadian indie artists, which we sponsor, and a lot of other fun things. So please take the time to tour online, even if not in person.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Sybil.
My pleasure. All the best to you.
And we had all these little boys.
they, of course, went all the way to the top, and I went as close to the bottom as I could.
I'm sure the city's developed a lot since you were last here. The downtown core railway lands have actually been now developed with a lot of condominiums and parks and restaurants, and there's more of a connection to the harbor front. And we're just within maybe 10 or 15-minute walk of probably the top tourist attractions in the city, including St. Lawrence Market, which is where you can go to all kinds of fantastic food stalls and butchers and cheese producers and so on. So there's a lot to do and see here.
Oh, yeah. In the summer, this is going to shoot to the top of our list.
I have a feeling that you're running a fifth column for the Government of Ontario Tourism Bureau. and you're doing an extremely fine job. I've actually been in Toronto. I think the last time was probably in the mid-1980s, and the trend you were talking about, the redevelopment of the land between the city and the lake, which was occupied by the old railroad tracks, that had already started, and it was clear that it was going to be complete very soon.
And the traffic was a nightmare.
Yeah.
I remember that, too.
Yeah, but we're certainly overdue to come and visit, so you may be sure we'll do that. In the meantime, Sybil, thank you so much for joining us on the menu, and please give our regards to your brewmeister from Bohemia.
I will. Well, I do welcome people to have a look virtually if they don't get a chance to come in person.
Okay.
Steamwhistle.ca is our website, and there's a fantastic virtual tour, a film you can look at. We have 150 recipes for cooking with beer. There's music you can download of the Canadian indie artists, which we sponsor, and a lot of other fun things. So please take the time to tour online, even if not in person.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Sybil.
My pleasure. All the best to you.
And that's a wrap. That's today's On the Menu program. We hope you'll join us again, same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.